Good evening. Welcome to Behind the News for December 27, 2007, the last show for 2007. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two interviews up for tonight. First, with the anthropologist David Graeber, who teaches at the University College London. He's not here yet, so I hope he does show up in the next few minutes because, well, if not, I have no first segment. And then at the bottom of the hour, we'll hear from Forrest Hilton, who is co-author of the book Revolutionary Horizons, Past and Present in Bolivian Politics. He wrote that along with Sinclair Thompson. A book came out from Verso earlier this year, and trying to do our political tour of the revolt against neoliberalism in Latin America. And one of those very important points of rebellion is Bolivia, the regime led by Evo Morales. But that is a regime with a long history, and we'll talk to Forrest Hilton about all that. Before we get to the first segment, whatever that may be, some words on the economic news. Yesterday brought the release of the best measure of house prices we have, the so-called S&P Case-Shiller Index. First developed by the economists Carl Case and Robert Shiller, and now published by the financial and economic analysis firm Standard & Poor's, it solves one of the major problems that have long plagued attempts to depict the trend in housing prices. What exactly is a house? Or more precisely, a representative house. Houses have been getting bigger over time, so if you just took a snapshot of house sales at a given moment and compared it to a snapshot taken some years in the past, you can end up comparing bungalows and McMansions. Instead of taking this approach, Case and Shiller track the same houses over the long term, so-called repeat sales index in the jargon of the trade, and compare their sale prices from one sale to the next. The better-known house price measures, like the National Association of Realtors' average of existing houses and the Census Bureau's for new houses, don't take these changes in the kinds of houses being sold into account. And the news in this Case-Shiller index was not so good. The national index was off almost 7% for the year ending in October, the steepest decline on record, though this measure's record doesn't go back all that far, just to 1987. Still, it surpasses the previous low of just over 6% set in April 1991 at the trough of the early 1990s housing slump. Other measures we have show that early 90s slump was the second worst housing decline in modern history, surpassed only by that of the mid-1970s. And there's no evidence that the thing now is stabilizing. In fact, if you look at what should be reasonable standards of house prices, like comparing average prices to average incomes, then the market is still quite overvalued and could easily fall by another 15 to 20%. Before continuing, I should say that conventional economic analysis treats rising house prices as good news and falling prices as bad news. But for people trying to put a roof over their heads, rising prices are little but bad news. The national fetish of treating houses as investment vehicles doesn't really make much sense if you think of it this way. But I'll have a real uphill battle trying to change the American consensus on this one, though probably not as hard a time as I'd have saying that the survival of the planet depends upon making driving cars more expensive. The two points are not unconnected. Among the hottest housing markets during the boom, which are also among those suffering the worst in the bust, are in places like Phoenix, Las Vegas, and San Diego, the development of which is a crime against nature. They don't have the water, and the sprawling scale favored in those regions means more driving and more resource waste. We need densification, not the building of housing tracts across the desert, and I doubt the housing bust is going to fix that. But the housing bust is bad news because people who are overextended are losing their houses, because they're finding themselves in debt for more than their house is worth, and because it's dragging down the average household's finances at a time when the job market is also slowing. It looks like the Christmas shopping season was, if not a disaster, a disappointment, though I must parenthetically point out that there's a severe structural problem with an economy that's so dependent on high and ever-rising levels of spending on stuff, although I'm hardly innocent of the practice myself. This morning, the Labor Department reported a modest rise in the level of first-time claims for unemployment insurance, and this figure has been working its way higher for almost 3 months now. Unemployment claims are a quick and timely measure of job loss. Unemployment claims are a quick and timely measure of job loss, but it doesn't look like employers are doing much hiring to compensate for the rising level of job loss. As part of its monthly survey of consumer attitudes, the Conference Board asks people their perceptions of the job market. For the first time since 2005, the number describing jobs as hard to get exceeded those describing them as plentiful. But back then, the plentiful line was rising and the hard-to-get line was falling. This time, the hard-to-get line has been rising, and as recently as July, the share of respondents describing jobs as plentiful exceeded those describing them as hard to get by 11 percentage points. This sort of crossing over, when a rising scarcity line crosses a falling plentiful line, is the kind of thing you normally see around the beginning of recessions. I don't know if we're in one of those. It's quite possible we're just slipping into a longer-term period of economic stress. In any case, the best is clearly over for this economic expansion, and it wasn't all that great to begin with. Unless you're Lloyd Blankfein, head of Goldman Sachs, who's had $70 million stuffed into his pay envelope throughout this year. How nice for him. All right, let's take a little musical break, and we'll be back with something else. Tell me that God is dead. Now tell me that Marx is dead. When his ties are this weapon, I don't feel too well myself, no. Oh no. Oh no. Oh no. They think I'm our God. A bitch. They think I figured out. A bitch. They think I'm our God. Okay. But I'm not too God, no doubt. Tell me that God is dead. Now tell me that Mark is dead. When it starts like this rapping, I don't feel too well myself, no. Oh, oh no. No. Oh no. Oh no. And that a bit of OK No Way from Mission of Burma. From, I think, around 1981. Don't tell me that God is dead. Don't tell me that Marx is dead. I'm not feeling so good myself. And I'm not feeling so good myself because the guest schedule for this segment, David Graeber, has decided not to show up. So I guess we're going to take some listener phone calls. And if you want to talk about the housing market or whatever, give a call to 212-209-2900. 212-209-2900, and we could talk about things economic and political, whatever is on your mind. 212-209-2900, the number to call. We'll talk about the declining housing market, the disappointing Christmas season, the price of gas, whatever. Is anyone out there? There we go. There's some calls coming in. Welcome to Behind the News. Hello, welcome to Behind the News. Hello, we got someone there?
Yes.
Ah, hello. Thank you.
How are you doing, Doug?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Not too bad. I was going to say, actually, if Dave doesn't show up, don't take it personally. He's
I guess that's anarchist, anarchist behavior.
I wasn't going to go that far. I know a lot of anarchists that are very prompt. He's just, let's say, overextended young man. That's all.
Okay.
Okay. As you mentioned, this you use the phrase that structural crisis, you know. It seems that, I read these articles in Economist, they compare, you know, U.S. economy to China and how, you know, in Chinese cases boom and, you know, U.S. cases bust. It seems more and more that, you know, it's just heading towards that kind of a structural crisis that was experienced, you know, in this society in 20s and 30s. And obviously, you know, it's not the same world. You know, it's a very different world. The world economy is a lot more developed. U.S. is only, you know, maybe at best only a quarter of the whole thing, if not less, but still. So the consequences of this, I guess, is very strategical, very important. And, you know, it could go obviously both ways. Could, you know, lead to progressive politics or reactionary.
Well, that's for sure, because, you know, well, the 30s weren't such a great model, except, well, the United States had the New Deal, but the rest of the world sank into fascism and then war. So, I don't know, people who hope for some sort of positive political development out of an economic crisis don't have a great record to point to for that. But yeah, I think you're onto something. I think I'm not sure what is going on, but it does seem like some kind of transition is underway. It does seem as if... we seem to have had David Graeber arrive. It does seem perhaps as if, you know, the U.S. star is declining and the star of China is rising. Although if we go back to the late 80s, it certainly looked that way about Japan. The U.S. star seemed to be falling then, and the Japanese were taking us over, and they were eating our lunch and setting us the bill. And then, you know, Japan entered an economic crisis. Spent the whole 90s going nowhere, deflation, recession, whatever, and it was not a very good time. So there's a saying on Wall Street, never predict anything, especially the future. It's also hard to predict the present. It's very hard to figure out just what is happening at the present moment, whether it's just another one of those financial crises, of which we've had many over the years, that have not all that much lasting economic or political significance, or whether this is really some sort of... crunch time for the U.S. Domination of the world scene. And I don't know. It's got to read this one day by day and week by week because something's going on, but it's really hard to figure out just what. So thank you for your call, and thanks to all, looks like eight or so of you who are on the line, but David Graeber has arrived. So we're going to resort to the tyranny of the schedule instead of spontaneity. And welcome, David Graeber, to Behind the News. Welcome, David.
Thank you very much. Sorry I'm late. I have a bit of a flu. I hope my voice keeps.
Well, I hope you feel better, and thanks for triumphing over ill health to show up here. I wanted to I haven't really identified you. You're teaching now at
Goldsmiths, University of London.
University of London. You were teaching at Yale, and you are quite a prolific author. Several books to your credit. I've got one here called "Lost People: Magic and the Legacy of Slavery in Madagascar," recently out from the University of Indiana Press, AK Press failed to get me a copy of whatever
book. Yeah, they tried. They claimed that it was in the mail. I don't know what happened.
Well,
I will yell at them for you.
Thank you. But plug that book while you're at it. What's the name of it?
Oh, it's called Possibilities, Essays on Hierarchy, Rebellion, and Desire. It's a collection of essays I've written over the last 15 years or so.
I wish I had had that in hand, because it would have been fun to – all those things sound like attractive items to talk about. But you got essentially – not exactly fired, but Yale decided not to continue your employment there. What's it like to be cold-shouldered by that august university?
Well, you know, it's funny. I never really expected anything else. I mean, you have to bear in mind that Yale, when you're a junior faculty member at Yale, your chance of tenure, I think statistically, is about 3%. So, I mean, somehow everybody manages to convince themselves they're going to be the great exceptions and then gets incredibly indignant and betrayed when the same thing happens.
When I was there, there was a member of the English department who got tenure, a very rare thing, but then he died.
Shock when he found out.
So it's not a good precedent, perhaps.
Yeah. No, I mean, I never expected to be there in the long run, and I'm not sure I would have been particularly comfortable being there in the long run, but I just thought of it as the greatest temporary job you could possibly have. But you know, I also knew that my politics would get me in trouble if and I thought I'd come up with a clever solution. What I basically did was I was an anarchist in New York and I was a scholar in New Haven, and I never got involved in anything having to do with campus politics or New Haven politics. Figure as long as I'm not stepping on their toes, what do they care? But apparently they cared. And
well, you know, it is an institution that one of the crucial links in perpetuating a ruling class in the United States, isn't it?
Yes.
Could you feel that in your day-to-day life there?
Oh, yes. I always thought, well, teaching undergraduates at Yale is actually really interesting for that reason, because it took me a couple years to realize what was going on, because from the very beginning I sort of was thinking, wow, I mean, half of these students are just amazing. They're just the smartest, most creative, most interesting, engaged students you could possibly imagine, and half of them are just kind of dumb. It was only after a couple years I realized...
In that George W. kind of way?
Well, yeah, it was only in... After about a year or two, I realized, oh, right, in about 15 years, all of the smart ones will be working for all of the dumb ones. That's basically what Yale is like.
It's also a fantastically rich place. There's an interview in the Alumni Magazine a couple of years ago with the president, Rick Levin, with the title, Can Yale Ever Be Too Rich?
God.
And guess what the answer is?
Yeah,
no.
I think I could. Yeah.
It can't be. But then, okay, let's talk a little bit about anthropology. You are a radical, an anarchist, and an anthropologist.
I am.
Anthropology is a discipline with a history of emerging kind of out of colonial study, isn't it?
It is, yeah. I mean, insofar as it was colonialism that made it possible for it to happen, yes.
Well, what was the relation of anthropology then to the colonial mission?
Well, it was irregular. I mean, the first anthropologists didn't actually go out into the world so much as wrote letters and sort of questionnaires, which they distribute to missionaries and local officials and people who actually were part of the apparatus of colonialism. So at the very beginning, it was very intimate. In the 20th century, there was a kind of a revolution within anthropology where anthropologists started going out themselves and meeting the people that they wrote about. And that really changed a lot. And from the 20th century, at least, anthropology has really been politically very much to the left, very much an anti-colonialist sort of tradition. It wasn't always able to be flagrant about that. And it's always there's always been a certain ambivalence. And that runs to this day when, I mean, there's a big move right now to turn American anthropology, at least to some degree, back into a colonial discipline, to hire anthropologists to work in Iraq and Afghanistan, sort of classic colonial administrative counterinsurgency ways.
And how's that being reacted to in the field?
Oh, God, it's horrible. I mean, for one thing, a lot of us, you know, especially people who study politicized communities, have to spend half our time trying to convince people that we're not part of the CIA. And, you know, being able to say, no, we don't work for the CIA, anthropologists don't do that, is helpful. The fact that now all of a sudden, and for a while that was true since the 70s, there was a kind of a moratorium on doing secret work for the government. But that went by the boards. And kind of invisibly, without anybody noticing it was happening until just a few years – well, just a few months ago, it really came out.
Even whatever the best intentions are of anthropologists, I think the field does have at least an image of people parachuting in, taking some notes and, you know, writing up their scholarly articles. But there's a, you know, almost a kind of, you know, patronizing or hierarchical relation that's implied in the way the work is done. Is that a fair perception?
Well, I mean, I think you have to distinguish between the ideal of the discipline and the context in which you have to do it. I mean, most anthropologists don't parachute in at all. Most anthropologists at this point spend about 2 years, some as many as 5 or 6 years, actually living with the people that they're writing about. So they're really the only people who have, you know, can speak the local language fluently, can have actually lived with people, done the things they do, have some idea what life is like. And so I think the sort of superficial critique of anthropology that was popular in the 80s has done a lot of damage because, you know, it allows a lot of people who would never actually want to go out to rural Nepal and, you know, use open-air latrines and have to boil their water every day for 2 years just like everybody else does there, you know, but sit at home in luxury, you know, think of themselves as more politically correct and more speaking for people in Nepal than the guys who actually know them.
I got to say, the idea of boiling water and using open-air latrines doesn't attract me to the field. But
no, but the other parts are fun.
Well, in this book I've got in my hand now, Lost People, you say you were attracted because it seems like the folks didn't get along with each other.
Yeah, well, you know, when you get social conflict and people are actually willing to talk about it, you know, you get excited.
And I've got to say, I only read the beginning and the end, so there's an awful lot that I missed in the middle. But I was curious, towards the end, you have these kind of reflections on the whole enterprise, in which you say that in the days before the kind of pre-colonial writings you get that Europeans did about what would eventually be the colonial world.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of variety in the narrative. And then suddenly when colonialism takes over, they just all become these
really boring,
timeless, dull. It's all about administration. Talk about that transformation.
Yeah. No, what I thought was really interesting here was when you read anything written by Europeans about Madagascar, say in the 19th century, when Madagascar is an independent kingdom, it's full of personalities. You know, there's there's magicians, there's princes, there's politicians, there's missionary, you know, devout Malagasy missionaries and Christians and evil sorcerers. I mean, there's all weird biases and stereotypes going on, but there's people. And everybody's trying to read the people and trying to figure out what they're doing. And one of the things that happens when you conquer people is you don't really care about individuals anymore, because the first thing you do is you create a situation where no individual can do anything that will particularly affect you. So, and administrative records, which is what you get, are all about sort of cyclical phenomena. Yearly this and seasonal that. And then you get this.
And then the natives become a people without a history, really.
Exactly. You take away their history, and then you say, oh, but these are people without history. And then you – but the interesting thing is what you do thinking that you're doing science, which is reduce people to these sort of statistical regularities, then gets projected onto them. But instead of making them scientists, it makes them into these strange mystical creatures that live in cyclical rather than linear historical time. You know, of course there's no history going on, because if anybody tries to make history, you shoot them.
Yes. How did that change in the post-colonial era?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, it shows the degree to which decolonization has actually taken place. I mean, a long time in Madagascar was an independent country in name, but not in practice. And that's true of a lot of French people who are still really running everything. And so it is much more the case than it was, you know, in the 1920s, that you have something like what you had in the 19th century where Malagasy people were really players. But it's surprising that it's sort of halfway there and not. And anthropology has sort of been struggling with that. I mean, to what degree is it about culture and the way people are all the same, or to what degree is it about the way people are all different? I mean, within a given society, it's about individuals and personalities. And what I really wanted to do in the book is bring out that, you know, when you're actually living in some place like rural Madagascar or New Guinea or Amazonia, or, you know, name the most exotic place you can think, you never are confronted with people who don't seem like people. You know, and the reason why they seem like anybody else you've ever known, even if they do odd things like, you know, take the bodies of their ancestors out of tombs and dance around with them, or whatever they might do, is because they're all different from each other in exactly the same ways that people are different from each other anywhere else. Some of them are like annoying loudmouth jerks, and some of them are shy, and some of them, you know, the differences between personalities are kind of the same. And somehow that doesn't carry over into the way we write about them. So you have this idea of the other, this sort of strange, unknowable creature that you don't even know if they're human in the same way you do, that everybody talks about as coming out of anthropology. No anthropologist has ever had that perception. And that's what's so odd about it, that somehow the experience that we all experience gets washed away in the way that we write about it, so that people who just read the books and haven't had the experience don't come get that aspect of it, which makes it so obvious that these people are just like us.
I got to say, you write about it with some wit and personality and charm, so you're not writing like all those other gray people.
Well,
fine. And I'm speaking with David Graeber, who is an anthropologist, teaches at University of London, Goldsmiths. Was Goldsmiths a school within the University of London?
Yeah, there's a series of campuses. Goldsmiths is kind of the radical, funky, artsy place.
And he's an author of several books, but what we were just talking a little bit about, Lost People, Magic and the Legacy of Slavery in Madagascar. And you've got a little rant against cultural relativism in there, which is kind of interesting.
Overblown relativism. That's also in the Possibilities book. Because that's often what anthropologists sort of get the rap for, these kind of extreme forms of relativism. And that comes out of that idea of the extreme other, that people are just so different that we cannot apply our standards to other people at all. And this is taken as a radical position, although it's always seemed to me that to some degree it's taken to its logical conclusion, it's a justification for apartheid. For example, I was at a conference once, and there were these people talking about, it's a famous essay about grief and the headhunter's rage, about these people somewhere in the Philippines who feel that an appropriate reaction to the death of a close relative is to go out and find some random person from an enemy group on the road and cut off their head. And
that kind of explains the American reaction invasion of Iraq.
No. One of the phases of mourning is usually rage, and that's what the guy was writing about in this famous essay. That you know, then his wife died, and he knew exactly how they felt, and he didn't really feel that different. And they were criticizing him for being universalizing, and you know, we can't understand these people, and how can you judge them, and so forth and so on. But what occurred to me was, well, you know, if you take the position of I have absolutely no basis on which to judge someone who feels that an appropriate reaction to the death of a loved one is to attack some random stranger and take off their head, then basically that attitude can only be held by people who have such complete dominance over the world that there's absolutely no way that someone who feels like that could be anywhere near their kids. And, you know, that's just, you know, guaranteed by the existence of, you know, borders and customs systems and airport controls. You know, a million different forces of coercion and brutality, you know, that can make us say, oh, we don't care what they think. We are superior because we refuse to sit in judgment. I mean, if we all live in the world together, we have to come to some sort of...
And also, if you want to be some sort of political radical, you have to have some standards of judgment of good and bad, don't you?
Exactly. And actually, I wrote about this in detail in the piece on oppression in the Possibilities book, because I was kind of amused to discover that there's almost no human language where there isn't a word which both means sort of pressing downwards and somebody is politically messing with you and making you miserable. That word oppression, that metaphor, it seems to occur to people everywhere. And the first thing I thought was, well, you know, what would an anthropologist have to say about that? And I realized almost nothing, because our instinct is to always say, oh, well, in cultural context, it means something very different, you know, is always to point out differences between people, which are real and important. But you lose something when that's all you do. And one thing I realized is that this kind of classical relativism, it on the one hand, it seems very radical to a level, but it only takes that level so far. And what it really is useful for is a sort of administrative logic, sort of sorting people into categories. Because if you say, well, the newer have their attitude toward this thing, and the Maasai have theirs, and we have ours, and these are all separate, and we can't really understand, you know, we can't sit in judgment on theirs, they can't over ours. The first thing you're saying is, okay, there are people called the newer, and they can be identified, and they all think the same thing, which of course they don't, right? But you can treat them as if they all say the same thing. Well, what does it mean when you take the Americans and say they all think the same thing? You know, what you're doing is exactly the same thing. You're finding those people who seem to be in authority and assuming they speak for everybody else. So in order to have a classic relativist position, what you have to do, well, basically the only thing that you can't relativize is authority. You have to have some universal standard to say, okay, this is this people, these are the guys who speak for them, these are these people. Which, if you look at what anthropologists often end up doing, that's what they often end up doing for, say, colonialists or now for the UN. You know, who are the real indigenous people who speak for them? Who do we recognize to speak for everybody else? Because if you look at, you know, everybody who you have classified as newer, there's nothing they all agree on. They're all arguing with each other all the time. So that's why it's interesting to point at the way that people argue about authority, using words like oppression, is often much more similar cross-culturally than what whoever you've identified as the authoritative person has to say.
All right. I think we have to bring it to a close here, assuming Forrest Hilton is outside.
Hope so. Hope he did better than me.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So... I've been speaking with David Graeber, and I wanted to talk to you about anarchism, so I'm going to have you back. When is the next time you're going to be in town?
I'll be back. Well, we have 10-week terms in England, so I'll be back in what's about 3 months.
All right. Well, let's come back in 3 months, and let's talk about anarchism.
I'll get that book to you.
Okay. Yeah, and then I'll get that book, and we can have a much more learned discussion. I've been speaking with David Graeber, who teaches at University College London at Goldsmiths, and is author of Lost People and Possibilities.
And Possibilities. I also have one called Constituent Imagination, which is a collected essays that I do with Stephen Chukaitis.
All right. Prolific fellow. David Graeber, thanks for joining us, and we'll see you in a couple of months. Let's take a break, and we'll be back.
We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI, New York City.
And this is WBAI. My name is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News. And not only are we at 99.5 FM on your FM dial, we're also on the web at WBAI.org. Let's take a musical break, and we'll be back with Forrest Hilton. That was the third of four pieces for clarinet and piano, Opus 5 by Alban Berg, performed by Sabina Meyer and Oleg Meisenberg. It's nice to have a piece that fits exactly into the one-minute time limit, if we do, to avoid offending the gods of iTunes. And we're now joined in the studio by Forrest Hilton, who is the co-author, along with Sinclair Thompson, of Revolutionary Horizons, Past and Present, in Bolivian politics. And I've got a little project going on here on Behind the News of looking at the various points of rebellion against neoliberalism occurring in the southern part of our hemisphere. So Bolivia, a very important one of those. And Forrest Hilton's book on Bolivia gives us not only the recent history, but the long history of how Evo Morales came to be in Bolivia. Welcome, Forrest.
Thanks very much for having me, Doug.
I think a lot of people heard about the election of Evo Morales, but of course there's a longer history that predates that election. Let's actually, since I have a little obsession with Jeffrey Sachs, let's begin our story with him and his intervention in Bolivia in the 1980s, which made him world famous and made him heavily in demand in Eastern Europe because he allegedly ended inflation, which went from 20,000 to zero practically overnight, but didn't do much to help Bolivia.
Right.
So tell us the story of Sachs and his intervention.
Okay, his shock treatment,
yeah,
as it were. As you pointed out, Bolivia had some of the highest levels of inflation ever recorded in world history, and the government that had been brought to power to replace a whole series of corrupt and increasingly narcotized dictatorships had not been able to steer the economy in a progressive direction. Inflation spiraled out of control as they emitted more and more money to try to pay off essentially different groups within society that they had made agreements with and could only fulfill by emitting more money. Into this chaos came the idea of a new political economy, though it was only so new insofar as it had clearly been tried out in Chile in the mid-1970s, and there were various other neoliberal experiments, and Jeffrey Sachs was a part of that. Another part of that was Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, who was the president overthrown in 2003 by a popular insurrection. Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada helped design what was called the new political economy, and it was essentially a set of neoliberal recipes for privatizing state enterprise as thoroughly as possible, liberalizing capital investment, and so forth. And I laugh when I say shock therapy, but that's actually the word that was used.
Jeffrey Sachs, of course, denies there's such a thing. If you
right.
ask him about it, no such thing. People right. are making this up. But
right. well,
of course,
at the
it was
time,
all too real to many, many millions of people who...
At the time, it was not only something that I think he was quite upfront and above board about. You know, as you mentioned, it was the beginning of an extremely, I'm not sure if it was lucrative so much as authoritative position about economics and how to redesign economies all through Eastern Europe and Russia. So Bolivia served him well as a sort of springboard to telling economies how to destroy the country in order to save it.
Yeah, Poland, Slovakia, and then Russia. So course, he didn't. Whenever anything goes wrong, he claims that people didn't follow his advice properly. Well, but throughout the oh, you had something to add?
Yeah, just in the case of Bolivia, the privatization of state enterprise immediately led to the mass firing of something like 20,000 tin mining workers. Tin miners had been at the forefront of popular movements in Bolivia from arguably the 1930s all the way through to the privatization of the mines in 85. So you can look at these privatization plans and neoliberal schemes as a very direct attack on forms of class power that subordinate groups had achieved in the previous period.
Which reminds us that inflation is a very political thing. I mean, economists always talk about it in very neutral, monetary and price terms, but it really is also about politics and conflict and shock therapy that is a form of class war. And,
Absolutely.
It's inseparable. We had a minor version of that in the United States when the Volcker, when Paul Volcker took over the Federal Reserve. Same thing, class war in the form of monetary policy. And it's too arcane for a lot of people to follow it, but it is a power struggle. So during the late 80s and throughout the 90s, Bolivia was kind of a poster country for neoliberalism, wasn't it?
Absolutely. It was held up as a model to follow. Jeffrey Sachs praised Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada, the fellow who, as a young technocrat and senator rising the ranks of the ruling National Revolutionary Movement, which is a political party, had become president in the meantime. Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada became president in 1993 to 1997, and that was really the period where Bolivia achieved its sort of maximum kind of worldwide recognition from international financial institutions for following the dictates, you know, to the letter, and putting this kind of human, progressive, multicultural facade of reform, you know, in order to give it a legitimacy that it simply didn't have in other places. So this took place between 93 and 97, and that was the period in which Jeffrey Sachs, who of course had become much more powerful and much more famous in the intervening years, said that Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada was the most intelligent neoliberal in the world.
Getting praised by Jeffrey Sachs is probably not something that is good for your reputation in the long term. I'm speaking with Forrest Hilton, who is the co-author of the book Revolutionary Horizons, Past and Present in Bolivian Politics, co-author Sinclair Thompson, and the book published earlier this year by Verso. So give us an idea of, first of all, Bolivia is one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere. It's much different from its larger neighbors throughout South America. Give us an idea of the economic and demographic profile of Bolivia. It's not a whole lot like a lot of other parts of South America, right?
That's absolutely right. And it's quite different from Peru, in fact, because one of the things that is important in understanding what's happening in Bolivia now is the resurgence of the indigenous population, which did not identify as indigenous previously and now does. In Peru, we don't see anything like that to the same degree, even though Peru and Bolivia would seem to be, you know, superficially similar from the outside. Its relations to its neighbors is, in fact, a very, very important point to understand what's happening in Bolivia now. Evo Morales, after successfully pushing a constitution through the Constitutional Assembly that he had convened for that purpose, began to celebrate with his followers. The Constitution still has to be approved in a popular nationwide referendum, but it has made it through the Congress or the Constitutional Assembly, and that was really the major obstacle. There were massive celebrations in La Paz on December 15th and so forth. But the really important part, what came next, was that immediately after the ratification of the Constitution by the Assembly, the heads of state from Chile and Brazil, Bolivia's two most powerful neighbors, immediately made high-level visits, presidential-level visits. Petrobras has announced that it is going to invest something like $750 million or a further $1 billion in order to implant and equipment and so forth and bring its facilities, its gas facilities in Bolivia up to speed. So Evo Morales, what's important about these neighbors and their support is that it's a much more multipolar situation than it used to be in Latin America, such that real support from the head of Brazil and Petrobras, and Chile comes in because Bolivia lost its coastline to the Chileans at the end of the 19th century, and it's been a sore point ever since. And in fact, one of the reasons Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada got overthrown in 2003 was because he wanted to close a sweetheart deal to export Bolivian gas through Chile, sort of behind the back of the public with no discussion or debate. And the fact that it was going to go through Chile, which had taken Bolivia's coastline, was something that struck a very deep nerve in terms of, you know, one thing Bolivians don't like to do is be seen as bowing and scraping before Chileans. It's a very sore point. And so this high-level visit from the president of Chile matters because she said, you know, well, with these deals that you're making with Brazil and Argentina, these are serious deals, these are serious negotiations, we are serious about opening a corridor to the Pacific. So some of Bolivia's major issues are actually being resolved with Brazil, with Argentina, because a gas deal, a very important gas deal to supply Buenos Aires with gas exported from Bolivia was just sealed with Argentina. And then Chile, on the other hand, has really markedly improved its relationship with Bolivia. So this is a source of Evo Morales' strength, because Bolivia, as you point out, is radically different than these other countries. It is landlocked, for one, and it also has the largest indigenous population in the Americas. 62% of the people in Bolivia identify as indigenous, according to the 2000 census. I believe it's 2000. So it's also topographically quite different, because you have this vast high plains district where much of the country's rural indigenous population lives, and then you have highland cities and commercial towns where another part of the indigenous population is concentrated, and this is all in the western region of the country. And then as you descend into the tropical lowlands, you have a whole bunch of people who have fled the crisis of agriculture in the highlands, which predated neoliberalism but was terribly exacerbated by it. And these people, in response to that agricultural crisis, migrated down into the eastern lowlands or the intermontane Andean valleys to cultivate coca. And the coca industry became, or the growing of coca, became an escape valve for people suffering under this kind of neoliberal shock treatment.
And, of course, Washington was trying to shut that down.
That's right. And that is exactly where Evo Morales rose to prominence as a leader, with these new colonizing forces in the lowlands who, you know, set out to settle an agrarian frontier and grow coca and find some way to make a living. The United States demonized Evo Morales. Evo Morales was able to demonstrate his capacity for leadership and show himself to be something of a national and popular hero. So then you have in the lowlands massive land holdings, many of them acquired fraudulently and illegally by elites who have benefited from government subsidies from the Western Highland region for the last 30 years. Now that they are in a position to exploit the natural gas reserves, almost all of which are in their region, now that they're in a position to exploit those in association with multinational capital, they don't want to share any of that wealth with either the lowland coca growers movement or any of the indigenous movements in the highland cities and countrysides. So it's a geographic division that's profound, and it's a racial division insofar as many of these people are profoundly discriminatory against Indians, openly racist against Indians in a way that here in the United States it's simply not acceptable to be with respect to any group because of shifts in the 60s. So you have a kind of polarization along racial ethnic lines in some ways, along geographical lines, geographical and regional lines. But of course, it ultimately comes down to politics and what are the different political programs. Because if we get too caught up in the fact that the guys in Santa Cruz are racists and many of Evo's supporters are of Indian ancestry, we can easily overlook, you know, what exactly is at stake in terms of control of these resources and the future of Bolivia.
I want to come back to that, but excuse me. I want to get step back to kind of trace the timeline of the revolution. And it was a revolution, even though it ended in an election. It was not a revolution of the Bolshevik type, but it was fits the definitions of revolution, as you demonstrate in the book. It started, I guess, really with the 2000 protest against water privatization in Cochabamba, right? Tell us that story.
Well, I think it was the International Monetary Fund or the World Bank. No, I'm sorry. It's the World Bank. Had told President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada as he was leaving office, his first term of office in 1997, that, you know, it would be a really good idea to privatize the water system. And, you know, there was extreme pressure. He was on his way out of office. It didn't happen while he was in office, although Sánchez de Lozada said, you know, he'd be sure to look after that for whoever was stepping in next. The person stepping in next was the former dictator, Hugo Banzer, who had run, I believe, five times previously before becoming elected. And he was based among these kind of reactionary, lowland, kind of narco-landlord elite is what I would call them. Banzer's whole program was to eradicate coca and privatize anything that was left to privatize. There wasn't much left. So one of the things that was left was water. And they tried to privatize the water in Cochabamba. And a whole range of popular forces began to come together to resist that privatization. Forces coming together of we're talking students, factory workers, coca growers from the surrounding countryside, peasants in charge of managing water use in the countryside, middle-class professionals eventually came aboard. So this was, on a municipal level, sort of a first act of the drama that would later be enacted nationally as forces that were previously fragmented and dispersed by the imposition of neoliberalism managed to regroup around a common demand, which was originally just to regulate the participation of this multinational consortium, Bechtel, of which Bechtel, I believe, was the leading player. And the idea was just to regulate that. But as the government responded with increasing violence and repression to popular protest, the demands were, of course, radicalized. And increasingly, the sense was, no, we need to get them out of here. You know, it's not enough to just regulate. These people need to be removed from the scene, and we need to manage our own water.
So, and then there was a tremendous crescendo to an uprising in 2003.
Exactly.
Why don't you describe that for us?
Well, that was the sweetheart deal that President Gonzalo Sánchez de Lozada had his eye on as he returned for a second term of office in 2002. He was hoping to kind of ram a deal of the export of Bolivian gas and the sort of repetition of all the old patterns of resource extraction that benefit a small minority of light-skinned comprador elites, leaving nothing but poverty and misery for the people, the majority of people who live in Bolivia. He was hoping to do this. And the people said, absolutely not, no way. And a whole range of groups once again mobilized, staged strikes, general strikes, paralyzed La Paz for at least 10 days running.
Like scores or maybe hundreds of thousands of people, right?
Yes, hundreds of thousands of people. People descended on the city from all over the country as reinforcements were needed. Much of this was communicated by cell phone and through community radio stations. So all kinds of plans, in fact, were being coordinated in indigenous languages, but the government didn't have anybody who was listening to any of these programs or understood the languages. So they were unable, really, to make even any basic sense of what was happening. But
so this really was that rare thing, a true revolution, true revolution from below.
Absolutely. Absolutely. What's interesting about it, of course, is the limits of that process because, as you said at the beginning, it led to the election of Evo Morales, which is not what we think of as the sort of, you know, well, wait, then it must not be a revolution if that was the outcome, right? We get so hung up on the outcome we forget about the process. But as you describe it, or as you note, the coming together of previously fragmented sectors who suffered brutally under neoliberalism up to and including middle-class fractions eventually joined in with a set of increasingly radical demands. Get rid of this president, nationalize the gas industry, that was first announced, and constitutional assembly. That was called the October Agenda. The October Agenda has sort of basically dictated who rises and falls in Bolivian politics, who gets elected. Evo Morales was elected because it was believed that he would be able to carry out the October agenda.
And he was elected in 2005?
He was elected, correct, at the end of 2005, mm-hmm. took power at the beginning of 2006, and has partially fulfilled many of these demands. And that's how he has strengthened his power as a president and for the executive, because there's no way that you could run Bolivia today and overlook those demands or try to install another set of demands as a political agenda.
Well, we have only a few minutes left, so if people want to know this story, should pick up the book. It's a very very interesting and lively story, of an inspiring story of a true revolution from below. The book, Revolutionary Horizons, Past and Present in Bolivian Politics, speaking with one of the authors, Forrest Hilton. The other is Sinclair Thompson, the book just out from Verso. But what do you think the prospects are for Morales? We're just about to celebrate, I guess, the second anniversary of his coming to power. Still a little new, but he's had some time in office. How's it going, and what's it look like for the coming years?
It's interesting. You know, many foreigners have been disappointed because of the government's apparent lack of radicalism. But if you look at Evo Morales, his party, and especially the kind of modus operandi they've adopted since coming to power, it's clear that they have other precedents in Bolivian history in mind, namely the National Revolution of 1952, where one group was able to establish itself as the center of gravity around which Bolivian politics turned. That is precisely the bid that Evo Morales and his friends are making. What does the future look like? Well, these landlord forces in the lowlands are now saying that they will not respect the Constitution, that they want full autonomy, that they will not share the resources. At the same time, they're cutting more and better deals with multinational petroleum companies, which is ultimately what they're interested in doing, and they're holding on to the most of their lands in the process. So it's important not to be deceived by appearances that we get in the foreign press that Bolivia is on the point of civil war, or that this is very similar to Chile in 1973. The Morales regime has been very successful at sort of bringing this right-wing minority into the process to some degree, such that even when they're fighting now, or appear to be fighting, you know, tooth and nail, in fact, Morales' government has a great deal of legitimacy, and it has been able to carry out most of its initiatives to its own satisfaction at the very least. Popular movements, the people who put Evo Morales in power, are currently more or less demobilized. It's much too early to say that they're in any way demoralized. They're certainly not satisfied with what's been delivered, but there is the promise of serious redistribution of wealth through these renegotiated gas contracts, and people are certainly hoping to see more schools, more hospitals, better employment conditions, and so forth, and they might see it. But the sort of revolutionary spirit of October kind of lives on, I would say, almost beneath the surface in terms of a horizon of what people might look for if this experiment and sort of constitutionalism proves unworkable.
Well, it's very easy to sit comfortably at a distance and criticize people for not being radical enough, but man, it really is hard to run a revolution. So I have nothing but admiration for what's going on there. Thanks for joining us, Forrest Hilton. Forrest is the co-author, along with Sinclair Thompson, of Revolutionary Horizons, Past and Present in Bolivian Politics, published earlier this year by Verso. And that's it for me, Doug Henwood. I will be back next week for the first show of the new year. Let's go out with a little bit of this from the French duo that operates under the name Justice. This is called Stress from their album Cross. Till next week. Bye.